The UK Psych Health and Safety and ISO 45003 podcast. The goal of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast is to be your source of information on psychological injury prevention, health promotion, and best practice. In doing this, we aim to rapidly advance the global practice of psychological health and safety in workplaces and adoption of best practices from the ISO 45003 standard. We will be looking at fully integrated approaches to managing psych health and safety and well-being strategy in the workplace that meet the needs of everyone in the organisation. Your regular host will be Peter Kelly, Senior Psychologist with the UK Health and Safety Executive, and Sheila Lord of BMR Health and Wellbeing. Every week, we will have a guest episode from the fields of health and safety, human resources, psychology, and academia who are leading the way in their corner of the globe.
So hello and welcome to our latest episode of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast. My name is Sheila Lord, and again I am joined by my co-host Peter Kelly from the UK HSE, and joining us today is our guest Gerard Fallin, who is a barrister QC working in the health and safety space. So Gerard, welcome to the podcast, and if you could basically tell our listeners about the work that you're doing around health and safety, that'd be great.
Well, thank you very much, Sheila. Thank you to you and Peter. Looking forward to this very, very much. In terms of my work around health and safety, I'm Queen's Counsel in London, but I've admitted to a number of other bars around the world. I've got chambers, for example, in Sydney, and I'm very proud to say that through this pandemic, at my ancient age, I sat and passed the Irish bar exams and was the last silk with another one called in December by the Chief Justice of Ireland into the Irish bar. And with Brexit, that was after quite a major transfer exam. I think things are going to get even harder. So I'm glad I got in just at that time. And that was good for my mental health, Sheila and Peter, sitting on my own
Lizzie.
An exam at my age. Just to make something very clear, Sheila and Peter, I act for everybody, not just everybody that pays me, because I even do a bit of pro bono work. There are lawyers out there that don't just go for money, quite a few of us, actually. But I act for everyone. I act for major corporates, I act for individuals, I act for regulators, I act for unions, I've acted for virtually everyone, directors, etc. So I haven't actually got an axe to grind on this. I'm not coming from any particular position. This is just genuinely what I am seeing crossing my desk now. It's my personal opinion. Obviously, I can't talk about any other cases that are live, nor will Peter be able to, or you, Sheila. We all know that. I can possibly talk about cases that have happened in the past, depending on that, on the basis that the rule is you can only talk about stuff that people could have seen sitting at the back of the court. So for those that are out there, who I don't know who they are, from different jurisdictions, it's quite helpful to say that. Can I just also say that I've worked in over 65 countries? I'm not saying that's unique, but it's certainly one of the very few of the London bar. And I'm very proud of that. But more importantly, that gives me a little bit of a different, not better, not worse, just different perspective on what we're going about to talk about today. All right. It's not better or worse. It's just different. And because I act for also local authorities, against local authorities, I haven't got just one perspective. I just want everyone to know that in advance. Thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you. Gerard. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the global impact of mental health as a result of this pandemic, as people transition back into work after they've been in lockdown. I've spoken about it on a number of occasions. I'm interested from your perspective, particularly how you see that maybe playing out through the courts or other areas.
Well, I mean, it's a very good question, Peter, and it's amazing. And it's it's an amazingly difficult area. And there's going to be a public inquiry starting next year into the COVID pandemic. And I'm hoping that some of this will be covered, depending on what's seen as the priority, because the priority should be, I hope, to prevent anything like this happening again. Having said that, I mean, personally, and I'm just talking personally because I don't really care anymore. I spent quite a long time of this on my own, and I found it extremely difficult coming from a background where, you know, I was basically on a plane every week around the world, certainly every 2 weeks. So to go from flying and moving and lecturing and speaking and being in different courts around the world to sitting in a flat on your own, I found incredibly difficult. It's one of the reasons I did the Irish bar exam, which took 2 months of my time full time to do it. So, and I know there's a lot of people much, much worse off than me. So may I just say that? And I, you know, a lot of people have lost their lives. I don't think we're ever going to get this back. The mental health will stay generationally. I've talked to a number of experts in this field. I haven't spoken to you about it, Peter. I just want to tell everyone that. So I'm not exactly sure where you're coming from, but that's good. This is generational. It will take years, if ever, to be able to get over. Coming back to work, we've had all kinds of issues with furloughs. People haven't worked for 16 months. That's going to be very, very difficult for people to come back. You know, even live court hearings, personally speaking, you know, on Zoom, they're different to live hearings. Lecturing is different to live. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of people that have been off the tools, as the expression goes. They're going to struggle to get it all back. And it's something we're going to have to build in to our system, Peter. Otherwise, we're heading for a disaster. Now, 2 weeks ago, roughly, I gave a speech on pilot aircrew mental health at the Royal Aeronautical Society with, alongside others, the Minister of Aviation for this country. And I made a number of points, just taking aircrew, because you can't talk about everybody. You know, a lot of them have had terrible stress. A lot of them have been made redundant. A lot of them are on furlough with a sword of Damocles hanging over them. Are they going to ever have their jobs? Are they not? Impacts on marriages, on mental and physical health. And the bottom line is, you're suddenly going to take, for example, aircrew pilots away from their families that have been together for 15 months, maybe for the first time in decades, you know, with the family unit, and then suddenly put them on a long haul flight back in the hotels, that kind of thing. I think the impact is going to be enormous. Now, this is not just the technical issue, because, of course, they'll be retrained. They'll be have been and will carry on being put in simulators, etc. But we just don't know where this is going to go. And one of the purposes of me being asked to speak at Royal Aeronautical Society, Peter, was we do not want another German Wings situation. And that is something that I think the industry is increasingly extremely alive to. It was before the pandemic. The pandemic, I'm sure, not a psychiatrist and not a psychologist, but I am sure will have tremendously increased the risks of serious mental health in aircrew. And of course, that goes all the way back to all of us, Peter. You know, you and I have grown up with risk assessment and methods cases and method statements. But now everyone's risk assessing. Everyone is PPEing. You know, do I go live to Sainsbury's or do I get a delivery? Do I cross the road now with that group of people coming or don't I? So we're now living what you and I have done, and Sheila, all our lives, which I think is a very good opportunity for the health and safety industry across all facets, the lawyers, the experts, the psychologists, the lecturers, the academics, the health and safety professional people. This is their time to seize this time. And I just hope it's used well. That's all I can say.
Because I do want to ask you about 45,001, but I want to ask you a more pertinent question from my own perspective. Over the last 20 years, I've tracked the case law, and I've tracked where case law's gone in this, particularly around mental health, you know, the psychiatric injury with the early cases, which is Walker versus Northumberland County Council, and then the Somerset Barber ruling. Do you think now, in the preceding couple of years, we will see new case law around mental health because of what people have gone through in their experience of COVID-19?
I mean, I don't know, but I would say it's extremely likely. And this is just my personal perspective, Peter. Yes. It's nothing to do with you or the HSE or Sheila. I can foresee, rightly or wrongly, a stepping up by the HSE in this country and other regulators around the world. Because remember, I do work in a number of other countries and jurisdictions, and I'm admitted to the bars and have appeared in courts in these jurisdictions. Regulators moving this up from carrot more to stick. And I can see that happening now very, very quickly. Now, of course, there are a number of massive beasts to fight coming out of this pandemic. And may I say, I'm sorry to say this, but we're not out of this yet. Mm. And boosters are being tested at the moment. I have a really big worry that we may have to reverse some of the opening up that's happening in this country and around the world. And I can imagine the impact on mental health of that is going to be enormous, like an elastic band. But I think, Peter, I don't know, but I am pretty confident that there will be more enforcement by regulators of health and safety, using health and safety law. I think it's only a question of time. Now, as you've intimated, those cases so far have tended to be in the civil courts, and there have been a number of improvement notices in relation to stress in this country and in other jurisdictions that I'm aware of. But I see that actually being ramped up to full, all singing, all dancing enforcement. And I just happen to know, because I've been told, not in a top secret way or anything, that certain experts, and I'm quoting, have said in an open forum, this would suggest that the HSE is gearing up for potential prosecutions. I'm aware that there's been some training of enforcement before the pandemic in relation to stress at the workplace. I don't know, Peter, but I can see this moving from not just the civil courts, but more and more into the criminal courts, not just in this country, but around the world. But that's just my guess.
How does 45,001 then? I mean, you, as you say, you know, you are an eminent authority on this and its interpretation within the law. So tell me about your work specifically around that and how you think that connects as we'll come into 45,003, which literally was just launched yesterday, which is a standard for psychological health, safety and well-being at work.
Well, I mean, just for those viewers that may or may not be aware of what we're talking about, can I just say 45001, and I speak from personal opinion, all right? And I also speak from personal experience. But this is a global standard, all right? So the bottom line is for organizations that work globally, more and more regulators will be looking to see what harmonization of their various attitudes and policies are to general health and safety across their organization. And I'm aware, for example, that in certain jurisdictions, that 45001 is being put by investigators to corporate senior management as to what was in place vis-a-vis 45001 in their organization. And for those, for example, that haven't got 45001 burnt into their brain, just giving two things, Sheila. Section 5.1 of that is leadership and commitment. Top management shall, look at that word, demonstrate leadership and commitment with respect to occupational health and safety management by taking overall responsibility and accountability for the prevention of work-related injury and ill health, as well as the provision of safe and healthy workplaces and activities, ensure that their policy and related objectives are established and compatible with the strategic direction of the organization, ensure the integration of the management system requirements into the organization's business processes, etc. There's another layer to that, Peter. There has been already in this country and in other jurisdictions case law whereby when sentencing corporates, the judges will increasingly look at the corporate culture of the organization wherever they've operated. So in terms of sentencing on aggravating or mitigating circumstances, there has been case law, it's not my opinion, there's been case law where the fact that remedial operations have not been properly done throughout the organization after an incident outside, for example, of this country, has been designated an aggravating factor by the sentencing judges in England. So it's not just academic, this. And I know you're going to ask me, well, I think you are, about 45003, and it's brilliant timing, Sheila and Peter, you know, having come out yesterday. Brilliant. I call it a daughter. It's known in the trade as a daughter or son of 45001. But I think in a way that's not correct, because the bottom line is that it's as important as 45001, some may even argue more important. And you see a marrying across between 45001 and 45003. And there's similar wording, which I wouldn't mind just a minute reading in bits from again, section 5, but also section 8 of ISO 45003. And I can envisage the same kind of approaches being taken by regulators and courts going forward, which may or may not, Peter, not for me to say, impact upon the question you just asked me in relation to what I thought you asked me what I thought the future may behold us, but none of us know.
I think, I mean, 45003 is a voluntary standard.
Of course.
45001 has been adopted by a collection of member countries, in which case it becomes more, it has a legal basis for it. So the mothership, as they called it, as we spent 3 years developing 45003. Sheila, do you want to, I've like hogged the speaking here. Do you want to ask any questions?
Yeah, I mean,
Sheila, can I just because yeah. I thank you. Can I just mention, so 45003 section 5.1.
Yes.
For those that won't have been lucky enough to have it yet, leadership and commitment. It says the successful management of psychosocial risk calls for the commitment throughout the organization. Top management should, look at that word again, should lead this, and managers and workers at all levels should drive it. Top management should demonstrate leadership and commitment to managing psychosocial risk. Identify, monitor, and be aware of its roles and responsibilities with respect to managing psychosocial risk, determine the resources needed, et cetera. And section 8, which I've mentioned, I just very briefly just like to cover that. Section 8, again, operational planning and control. The organization should plan, implement, control, and maintain its processes to adequately and effectively manage psychosocial risks, including actions on activities to eliminate hazards, reduce psychosocial risk by considering the best fit between task structures, work processes, and the needs of workers. You know, so that's without going into all the detail, because we could be here for 2 weeks, Sheila, just doing ISO 45001 and 3. People have to read this properly themselves. I can't even say
I think for the purposes of those who are not familiar with the word should in a standard has greater weight
So it's a clear statement of, you should do this.
Yeah.
So as opposed to you shall. And I can tell you, many a conversation was had over Section 8 and Section 5 in order to get that in there. So, yeah.
Right. So, Sheila, sorry. I thanks very much, Peter, for letting me just... Because I promised I would say it, so I wanted to...
I've got it in front of me, and it was word for word, so...
Thank you.
Okay, so one thing I come across quite a lot, Gerard, is that organisations still not all very clear with regards to their legal duty for psychological risk assessment and for managing psychosocial risk. So it's very much in a lot of organisations, and I think in a lot of small businesses, seen as almost as an employee benefit that we're actually going to have these types of initiatives in place. I mean, what would be your kind of advice or your viewpoint to those organisations, you know?
Well, I can't advise the world, but I mean, I'm not ducking your question, Sheila, but you know, obviously, I can't give advice to every single person and every organisation in every country. I just can't do that. But I think arguing it a different way or putting it a different way.
Yeah.
I mean, there are moral arguments about this. There's safety performance issues. I mean, you guys know this much more than me, and the people that will be listening to this webinar are experts in the field. There's financial benefit, and there is legal issues. There's no doubt about it. I mean, one of the things that you said to me, Sheila, you might ask me about, was in relation to sort of corporate manslaughter or corporate killing, which is, you know, depending on where you are in the world. And I think it's important, because I don't know who's out there, that, you know, I'm speaking as a Anglo-American lawyer, i.e. this is common law we're talking about. Vast tracts of the world, more than the common law, come under, for example, Code Napoleonic civil law. France and Spain and most of Latin America, a lot of Asia, etc. So they have a different perspective to this legally, and I just wanted to make that point. But in terms of sort of common law manslaughter, I'm sort of answering your point the wrong way round, you know? But I think it's just important to bear in mind that under the corporate manslaughter killing legislation in this country, one of the factors under the Corporate Manslaughter Act 2007, when, and I'm not saying that these cases will become a corporate manslaughter prosecution. Who knows? But I can see difficulties with it, but I can't say it's never going to happen. The jury has to consider the extent to which the evidence shows there were attitudes, policies, systems, or accepted practices within the organization that were likely to have encouraged any such failure or to have produced tolerance of it. And one of the things the jury has to measure that by is regard to any health and safety guidance that relates to the alleged breach. So putting it in a different way, I don't think this whole area is something that is a sort of an add-on, bolt-on, if you fancy it. I think it's intricate into the whole organization's preparation globally for health and safety, of which this is an element and an important constituent element.
Okay. So, I mean, it is clear, isn't it? There's absolutely a legal duty of care from employers globally around the world. And, you know, as Peter alluded to before, you know, coming out of this pandemic, are we going to see more and more cases of you know, employees basically kind of kicking back against employers that aren't necessarily behaving in a way that they should?
I think the civil courts and the employment tribunals are going to be very, very, very busy indeed, Sheila. Let's put it that way. The other kind of thing, and I'm not being flippant, Sheila.
I would agree, though, with the civil. I mean, I know I spoke to Andrew Buchanan about 2 years ago and saying actually that you can see the potential for these cases to come. That was before the pandemic. So
and it's interesting, just taking that thread, and I'm not being flippant, guys, but, you know, the employment lawyers are very, very busy in this country. I know that. The busiest lawyers are the insolvency restructuring lawyers and the family lawyers, divorce, child care, child custody, Hague Convention type work. You know, because this pandemic has put extreme stress on families and marriages that may or may not have been 100% intacto have been put under massive stress. And I'm sad to say that huge numbers are breaking up. And of course, you know, relationships where people haven't been married, et cetera, et cetera. And the impact this has on children and the schooling issue and all of that is going to be enormous. And just something that Peter's just said, very interestingly, before the pandemic, all right, the HSE, and I'm quoting Peter talking toolkit, go home healthy, preventing work-related stress. This is a direct quote. Across the Great Britain, work-related stress accounts for over half, 57% of all working days lost to ill health. In the last 12 months, over 600,000 workers reported suffering from stress, depression, or anxiety caused or made worse by work. Now, may I stress again, that was before the pandemic. I have no idea, but I'd be amazed if those figures aren't much higher.
1 week before the pandemic, the figures are 828,000 people off, 17.9 million days lost to work-related stress, depression, and anxiety. 1 week into the pandemic, that doesn't even matter. The next set of data is due out in October, which will cover the full pandemic period. So we'll either have presenteeism, because people are working home and hiding it, or we will see an increase. But if anyone thinks that somehow the mental health crisis that was emerging before the pandemic is somehow going to stop and stall, the academics, experts across the world, and you know, barristers as well, are saying no. Actually, we're looking at a global mental health crisis, and we have to do something about it.
Can I just say, Peter, there was a survey done recently by the Legal Aid criminal lawyers, and they've been through tremendous stress because they've been down the cells, you know, all the way through this, the courts, etc. And they're reporting very high levels of stress, financial, because they haven't been paid. The court shut for many months. Obviously, they're doing their best to catch up. There was already a huge backlog. So what I'm trying to say is pilots, lawyers, across all a plethora of industries and people, they're going to be affected financially. Wait till furlough ends. Wait till the bailout ends. You know, anyway, so I think those figures will be fascinating, Peter, and I will be queuing up to be one of the first, I hope, to look at those figures, because I think they'll be really interesting.
Yes, they will. And then as we're nearly coming to a close, but Sheila, do you have any last questions you want to ask?
Well, really, for Gerard, is kind of what would be, you know, a piece of advice, one big takeaway you can give to business leaders coming, you know, as we're starting to transition out of the pandemic? I mean, I know you talked before when you referred to the standard about leadership and leadership commitment. And we know, you know, we all on this call know if, you know, we don't get leadership committing to it, if we don't get genuine commitment and compassion and empathy from leadership, these types of initiatives in terms of getting this done right in the workplace are not going to happen. Mm. Not going to happen well. What would your advice be to those business leaders out there?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, you hadn't asked me, I would have thought a little more about it. And I'm always a bit nervous to go off the hoof, but I could just be really honest with you. Well, I always try and be honest. Trust me, I'm a lawyer.
You know.
The, end, the end of the day, the tests, I mean, I was fortunate enough to be in one of the leading cases called Porter that has been adopted by the Supreme Court in civil and criminal divisions, where the law of risk changed to one, it's got to be real risk, not fanciful or hypothetical risk. And you can normally exclude the normal risks of life. But notice that word hypothetical. So it's what the test is, what people, not just boards, Sheila, all of us, you, me, Peter, what we ought to have known rather than what we said we knew. It's an objective, not a subjective test. And I think finally, and it's not my quote, but I completely endorse it. If you think all of this is expensive to implement, maintain, and monitor, try a major accident. Because I can tell you, it's not just the stress of the enforcement. It has massive implications on reputation, on morale. For example, you know, if there's a construction situation, people don't want to work in that site anymore if they have to walk past where poor Fred was crushed to death or something. You know, the bottom line is, you know, reputational issue. And I mean, we're talking about health and safety, but, you know, we could talk about product liability. We could talk about environment. We could talk about data, cyber attacks. All of this stuff is interconnected. And you know, if I had to one takeaway, it's that. If you think this is expensive, just wait. And it's the management time and anxiety that it causes. A small incident can suck in huge amounts of resources of time and effort and stress and money. So I think that's probably more than one. But, it, you know, that's what I probably would say.
But you're a lawyer, so it always takes a longer
closing arguments.
So that, I mean, that's been brilliant. Thank you very much for that opportunity to chat and to
get
it together. And hopefully you'll listen to the podcast when it goes up.
Okay. And well done for all your work. Both of you and Peter and everyone on ISO 45003. I mean, I've looked at it. I can't say I know every single thing about it. I will one day, but I'm really grateful.
Well, happy to talk about it. I've had to live with it for 2 years. So.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. Well done for all of that.
Yeah.
And look forward to seeing you all again.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard. Thanks.
Bye-bye. God bless.
You've been listening to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention and the new ISO 45003 standard, follow subscribe to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.ukpsychhealthandsafety.com.